Today is Friday, January 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Congress is in session as it opens with a historic number of minorities and women.
Proud to be a woman Speaker of the House of this Congress, which marks the 100th year of women having the right to vote.
The partial government shutdown continues as neither side budges on the president's demand for border wall funding. An announcement by Apple CEO sinks stocks worldwide. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Democrat Nancy Pelosi addressed the new U.S. Congress after being elected Thursday to be the new Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives as her party took majority control of the chamber following its election victory last November 6th.
New members of Congress, newly reelected members of Congress, thank you for your courage to run for office and to serve in this distinguished body. Every 2 years, we gather in this chamber for a sacred ritual under the dome of this temple of democracy, the capital of the United States. We renew the great American experiment.
This marked Pelosi's second stint as Speaker. She was the first woman ever to hold the job, serving from 2007 until 2011, when Republicans began an eight-year run in the House majority. Noting this is the 100th year, as you heard, that women had the right to vote, she also noted other historic significance of this new Congress.
And that we all have the ability and the privilege to serve with over 100 women members of Congress, the largest number in history.
Well, the election puts Pelosi in position to lead the opposition to President Trump's agenda and to conduct in-depth investigations of his administration following 2 years during which Republicans have mainly given him a free pass. But Thursday, the president did take the high road and publicly congratulated Pelosi.
It's a very, very great achievement. And hopefully we're going to work together and we're going to get lots of things done, like infrastructure and so much more. I know they want to do that very badly, so do I. So hopefully we're going to have a lot of things that we can get done together. And I think it's actually going to work out. I think it'll be a little bit different than a lot of people are thinking. So I congratulate Nancy. Tremendous, tremendous achievement.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson was on Capitol Hill to witness Thursday's congressional opening. I talked to her about it earlier. Another historic day. We've a historic number of women, and we've got Nancy Pelosi now taking the reins of Speaker of the House, a very powerful position. You were there. Tell us about it.
That's right. I was right outside the House chamber for this historic moment. Nancy Pelosi becoming only the second person in the last half century to resume the speakership of the U.S. House of Representatives, which was, of course, a very exciting moment for the House Democrats and their incoming majority. A lot of applause, a lot of joking, you know, families and children on the House floor. So it was a very fun ceremonial day up on Capitol Hill, which is something we don't get a lot of up there.
The joking obviously gets serious very quickly now that we've got a government or partial government shutdown that obviously is very top of mind with this new House now in session.
That's right. They had to get right down to work today. They didn't even get one day of ceremonies and pomp and circumstance up on the Hill. The House Democrats are going to pass a package of spending bills that they want to reopen the government. Now, unfortunately, they're going to send that package of bills over to the U.S. Senate, and it's almost certainly not going to pass over there because Mitch McConnell has said that he is going to follow the president's lead today. Of course, we heard from President Trump that he's not going to budge until he gets that money for a border wall.
I know they have a lot on their plate right now. The incoming majority Democrats are looking to hold the president accountable and checks and balances here. They've got a lot that they are looking to deal with. And obviously with the shutdown, that's going to take up a lot of their time right now. Anyway, is there any end in sight right now for that, for the shutdown to end?
Mitch McConnell told reporters that it may be weeks until they sort this out. I think that possibly one option that they could take is to take that package of six spending bills that opens up almost all the government agencies that are not funded right now. Then they could do a separate spending bill for the Department of Homeland Security, which of course oversees the enforcement on the U.S. border. They could do a shorter term spending bill for the DHS and then just kind of fight their way through the border wall discussion that way, while bringing all of those government workers back to work and getting them their paychecks.
Now, with Democrats having a majority again in the House of Representatives, what are some of the things they are hoping to focus on?
Well, the first big bill that's up for business is H.R. 1, which is a bill addressing government corruption. And it's one that a lot of Democrats ran on during the 2018 midterm elections that they said resonated with a lot of voters, a sense that there's too much money in politics and that people really need to have clear, accountable government officials and lawmakers who they know are really working for them when they come to Washington. So that bill will address a whole range of issues that Democrats feel have built up over the last few years to hold people accountable.
What about some of the investigations involving the president?
Well, those are certainly getting ramped up. Incoming House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff was tweeting today that the Trump administration has gone without accountability for too long. And that as of today, with 116th Congress starting and Schiff taking over on House Intel, that's ended.
And just before I let you go, Catherine, this is a really new day for American politics in that we are seeing a lot of firsts in respect to diversity in Congress now.
That is so right, because most of my job is following lawmakers, is watching the House floor, looking at these representatives every day, day in and day out. And what really struck me today, seeing the new Congress, is how different they look. You saw so many more women on the House side for the Democrats. You saw people of color. You saw the first two Native American representatives, the first Somali American representative, Black women who are representing New England states for the first time. So many firsts, and it just struck me to see that in a very visual way as this new Congress came in.
Thanks so much, Catherine. And one of Pelosi's first orders of business Thursday was to send a letter to President Donald Trump inviting him to deliver the State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress on January 29th. Well, the partial U.S. government shutdown is now poised to enter its third week as President Trump and Democratic lawmakers have so far been able to reach a deal. Trump continues to demand $5 billion to build a wall on the southern U.S. border with Mexico. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has the latest.
American border agents launched tear gas at migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border at Tijuana early Tuesday. While in Washington, President Donald Trump continues to demand $5 billion to build a border wall. He rejected a back-channel compromise offered by his own Vice President Mike Pence for half the amount.
No, we're asking for 5.6. And, you know, somebody said 2.5. Now, look, this is national security we're talking about.
Trump met Democratic and Republican lawmakers behind closed doors of the White House Situation Room. The meeting failed to reach consensus. Trump has invited lawmakers to meet again Friday after Congress elects its leaders. Nancy Pelosi is expected to be the next Speaker of the House.
Our question to the president and to the Republicans is, why don't you accept what you have already done to open up government? And that enables us to have 30 days to negotiate for border security.
Democrats will take over control of the House of Representatives on January 3rd and will pass legislation to fund all the closed government agencies through September, with a separate bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security, which manages border security, through February. Even if the bill passes in the Republican-controlled Senate, it could still face a Trump veto.
As long as it takes, I mean, look, I'm prepared. I think the people of the country think I'm right.
The shutdown, now well into its second week, means more than 800,000 government employees will continue to be furloughed or working without pay. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Russia has reportedly charged a former U.S. Marine with espionage. A rebel infighting escalates in northwest Syria. The U.S. Congress may soon rule on a tire. And a Gulf rift is widening as Qatar quits OPEC. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Apple's shock warning that its Chinese sales are weakening ratcheted up concerns about the world's second largest economy and weighed heavily on global stock markets as well as the dollar on Thursday. In a letter to shareholders Wednesday, Apple CEO Tim Cook said iPhone demand is waning in China and would hurt revenue. Cook said Apple expects revenue of almost a tenth lower than the consensus expectation in financial markets.
We look at what's going on in China. It's clear that the economy began to slow there for the second half. And what I believe to be the case is the trade tensions between the United States and China put additional pressure on their economy.
Apple's warning, its first since 2002, has deepened concerns about the Chinese economy, which had been showing signs of stress amid a trade war with the United States. Joining us to talk about it is Peter Morici, an economist and professor of international business at the R.H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. What is your reaction to Apple CEO Tim Cook's message about the trade war with China dramatically impacting sales?
Well, I think Tim Cook was looking for excuses. So he blamed the trade war and he blamed conditions in China. The reality is the market's saturated. He sells a very expensive phone. He doesn't have many low-cost options. And he raised prices a great deal. Some as much as 20 or so percent on the less expensive phones. And he's discovered that people will buy other phones. They'll make the phones they have last longer. Tim Cook needs to find a new business model. Simply jacking up the price of an iPhone every year no longer works.
Not many people can afford to pay $1,000 for a cell phone. That's certain.
And more, because every time you buy an iPhone, all the peripherals have to change too. They got to have it structured that way. They seem to believe that people wanted to spend all their discretionary income at the iPhone store, and that is silly. More than that, Tim Cook is at a bit of a loss as to find other businesses. They are growing, but some of this stuff is absolutely comical. For example, I think, you know, all of a sudden he's Howard Hughes running RKO. He's going to have his own media business for Apple TV, and he's putting his hand into it. He's decided that, you know, the kind of content they're going to have. It sort of reminds me of my fantasies in managing the New York Yankees. Tim Cook knows how to make phones with cheap labor in China. They're elegantly designed. They're beautiful phones, but that's what he knows how to do.
Besides the situation with Apple, do you think that this trade war with China and the United States is starting to hurt folks in China and the U.S.? Do you think it's actually becoming...
No, it kind of reminds me of Coca-Cola blaming the steel tariffs for its troubles. Coca-Cola doesn't use any steel. Coca-Cola sells concentrate to bottlers, and bottlers are spending a couple of pennies more per six-pack on cans, you know, because of the aluminum. Most of the tariffs that Donald Trump has imposed are 10%. The value of the yuan since April has gone down almost 10%. So how can they have much of a pricing effect? The reality is that China has got endemic structural problems that it has to address. It has studied very closely the Japanese experience, but it seems to have quit around inning six. It doesn't seem to want to go to the end of the game in that diary where Japan runs out of space to export to the United States. What China has done is exported so much to the United States and caused so much dislocation in the middle of the country that U.S. growth is slowed to the point that there are absolute limits to what China can send here. What's more, the Chinese are endemic thieves and fundamentally dishonest. They don't seem to ever be able to go into a situation where they don't want to get the better end of things. Think of how much of this message is pushing back on President Xi. He's getting a lot of heat from the next level down about the reputational problems the Chinese have these days because of their kind of behavior. And the State Department just issued a warning to Americans about travel to China because you may get arrested. They're trumping up charges. People go on tours. They're trumping up charges to seize Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've always done that to Chinese nationals that come and study abroad and then go home and they say, well, you weren't very faithful in your comments. But now the State Department is now warning Americans not to go to China.
So who wins in this trade war? Do we win? Will we ultimately get it resolved? We have negotiations next week. There are formal talks next week.
There's a lot of pressure on Xi and on Trump to deal. On Xi because of economic conditions at home and the political pressures, he doesn't seem to be as invulnerable as he was 6 months ago. But Trump has staked so much his on the stock market, you know, being a barometer of his success, that the troubles in the U.S. stock market have nothing to do with the trade war, nothing whatsoever. They have to do with the fact that the five principal tech companies each have a problem like Apple's. With Netflix, it's other media companies cropping up and a terrible upheaval among its workforce that the place is, not a good place to work. It's terribly unfair. Google and Amazon have got antitrust problems. Google's got a bullseye on its chest for its invasion of privacy, and on it goes. I mean, just every one of the fangs has got problems, and they have been responsible for most of the run-up in the market. Now, what that means is other companies are greatly undervalued because they haven't been rising nearly as much.
We've been hearing a lot about the U.S. economy weakening. We could potentially be heading toward a recession. We've seen unbelievable volatility in the last couple months in the stock market. Do you expect more market turmoil here and abroad with all this chaos?
Oh, abroad, I expect more market problems because, frankly, China hasn't figured out how to grow without stealing, and the Europeans haven't figured out how to grow at all. I mean, the last three decades in Europe have been terrible, largely because of the dysfunctions in the euro and the problems imposed by a bureaucracy that has no democratic accountability. In the United States, the economy was supposed to slow a bit in 2019, but now it's in real jeopardy because folks just don't have confidence in two people, Donald Trump and Fed Chairman Powell. Fed Chairman Powell is a lawyer who's trying to do economics off of freshman Cliff Notes, and Donald Trump's erratic behavior inspires very little confidence in his stewardship. So basically, the U.S. economy is headed for trouble because people don't have confidence in Fed Chairman Powell and Donald Trump because of his erratic behavior.
That's Peter Morici, an economist, professor of international business at the R.H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Well, this has been a very significant week in space exploration for the United States and China. From NASA's New Horizons spacecraft sending back photos of the most distant flyby of an object ever explored, and Chinese state media announcing that a space probe made its first ever successful landing on the far side of the moon. China Central TV announced Thursday that the Chang'e 4 probe touched down just weeks after it was launched early last month from the Xizhang Satellite Launch Center in southern China. Shortly after landing, the Chang'e 4 sent a photo of the lunar surface. VOA's Jim Bertel talked about it with John Logsdon, professor emeritus of political science and international affairs and the founder of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University.
Let's begin with China landing a rover on the moon. Why is this significant?
Well, because we've never been there before. It's landed on the far side of the moon, and humans have never landed in that part of our nearby satellite. So it's true exploration. It's going places that no one has been before.
And what can we expect to find on the far side of the moon that astronauts and robotic craft haven't found on the side that faces the Earth?
Well, the geology on the far side is apparently very different. I mean, there have been orbiters, and of course, the crews that transited the far side during the Apollo missions all looked down and saw what the far side looked like, and it's very different, and it's older. And I think we expect to get new information about the origins of the moon, the evolution of the moon, and its place in the evolution of our solar system.
Do you see this as a precursor to a manned mission by the Chinese to the moon?
Well, they say it is. China has set out very detailed plans. This, after all, is Chang'e 4. There was a 1 and 2, which were orbiters, a 3, which was a lander and rover on the front side, the near side of the moon, and Chang'e 5 to be launched later this year. It will bring samples of the moon back to Earth. So China has said somewhere after 2030 they intend to send humans to the moon, and I have every confidence they will do it.
Now, the U.S. has been focusing its exploration primarily on Mars and the outer planets. Is China focused more on the moon than Russia or the United States?
Well, yeah, I think not only China, India has gone to the moon, Japan has gone to the moon. First of all, it's nearby. I mean, it's only a quarter of a million miles away compared to Ultima Thule, you know, at 4 billion miles distance. So countries just getting started in space exploration kind of logically concentrate on the moon.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Ultima Thule. It was visited this week by the New Horizons spacecraft, a first for NASA. Before we talk about this week's accomplishment, explain to us the original mission of New Horizons.
Well, the original mission was to explore Pluto and its moons and probably try to convince us that Pluto deserves to be brought back and given status as a planet. We had visited every planet in the solar system except Pluto. And then in 2015, as New Horizons flew by Pluto, we got remarkable images and information and found that it was an exciting new world, not only Pluto, but its major moon, Charon. So it was a remarkable act of discovery. And this is visit to Ultima 2 is kind of the second act.
Well, that's a good way to put it, the second act. Why was the flyby of Ultima Thule significant?
Well, because it happened. We'd never visited an object in the so-called Kuiper Belt, which is the outer reaches of our solar system. We'd never seen anything out there. And we found ourselves a very interesting-looking snowman or bowling ball, bowling pin, however you want to characterize it, object to take a look at.
And what's next for the New Horizons spacecraft?
They hope to get permission to continue to another object, to navigate to another flyby. That depends on the ability to get the money necessary to keep this science and operations teams in being. But, I mean, the spacecraft is going to keep going. The question is whether it goes someplace in the next few years that gives us another place to see for the first time.
We have just a few seconds left. Are there any other space milestones to look forward to this year?
Yeah, I think the United States is going to be launching humans from U.S. spacecraft from U.S. soil. So something that hasn't happened for 8 years, and that gets us back in the human spaceflight business in a very active way.
That's John Logsdon, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Female circumcision, a practice that opponents call female genital mutilation, has been a coming-of-age ritual among the Maasai tribe of Kenya for generations. But it's becoming less common, in part, because of a man who's trying to persuade tribe members to abandon the practice. Douglas Merite began his campaign about 10 years ago, and he spoke to Raul Amumbor, who reports for VOA from the Kumana settlement in southern Kenya.
Douglas Merite grew up in the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro as a member of the Maasai tribe.
I remember when I was in primary school, when I was a young boy, I would look around my class and see only Maasai boys. The girls were from other tribes, but rarely Maasai girls.
Merite says the girls were being married off at a young age after undergoing female circumcision, a traditional rite of womanhood among the Maasai. But activists call it female genital mutilation, FGM, because of the permanent damage caused by cutting a woman's clitoris. Lilena Shepai underwent the procedure as a young girl and says excessive bleeding is common and some even die.
We know the girls who have not been circumcised. Sometimes they visit these homes. I ask, where is so-and-so? They say she is here. If she is walking properly, I know that she has not been circumcised. If the girl is not walking properly, we arrest the father and mother.
In the Maasai community, women are the ones who perform the cutting and therefore have the power to end the practice. So Merite works closely with Maasai women. He says since 2008, he has rescued over 100 girls from FGM, but had to first face off with his own people and tradition.
When we started this campaign, it was difficult. Others would ask, has Douglas gone mad? Even as they continued to speak. This was something that was deep in my heart. I did not give up. When I heard of any form of meeting in the area, I would come in and speak against FGM.
Campaigns like Merite's led to Kenya outlawing FGM in 2011. But the practice still occurs in remote rural areas, says Kimana's chief, Joseph Parmuat.
We work with Douglas to reach such girls. When we get that information, we have police on standby. We go to the location, arrest all those involved, the parents, the person who performed the act, then we take the girl to the rescue center.
According to a 2016 United Nations report, one in five females in Kenya have undergone FGM, but those numbers are going down. Authorities and campaigners, including Merite, are promoting an alternative rite of passage where girls are graduated into womanhood without the cutting. Raya Lombor, for VOA News, Kimana.
Well, the world's wildlife remains under increasing pressure due to human encroachment, the effects of climate change, and especially poaching. It's estimated that the global wildlife trafficking market is worth up to $23 billion, but conservationists are fighting back to save some of the most endangered species left on the planet. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports.
From the tropical treetops to the African savanna, the world's most charismatic species are threatened by poachers and traffickers. And it's not just the cute and cuddly species that are victims. Hundreds of thousands of spiders, frogs, reptiles, and invertebrates are smuggled from their native habitat each year. The golden poison dart frog is the most trafficked species in Colombia. Inadequate border controls and a lack of training for custom officials have been identified as weaknesses that allow the multi-billion-dollar trade to continue. In Africa, immigration and wildlife officials from Kenya and Tanzania are being trained by the International Fund for Animal Welfare to identify illegal wildlife products.
To say that the border of Kenya and Tanzania is porous is an understatement. It's wide open. And in some respects, it should be, because there are Maasai and other indigenous communities that live on both sides of the border. And to them, that border is imaginary.
Conservationists have been working hard to protect the black rhino from poachers. Translocating, microchipping, and dehorning rhinos are strategies used by Kenyan officials to help build up and protect their herds. Thanks to stepped-up protection measures, populations of gorillas in Uganda and Rwanda have increased. Gorilla tourism is an important income source for Rwanda, but an increase in permit fees for safaris saw a steep decline in visitors. So in August, fees were reduced by 30% for the low season in the hope that visitors would return to the mountains to view the primates up close. As conservation efforts worldwide begin to bear fruit, another danger is threatening animal and plant species all over the world: climate change. Conservation groups are working to understand how the changes are affecting wildlife and developing ways to help species adapt. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thanks for joining us on today's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.